up, everybody? This is Radio Free Nintendo, episode 195. And with me today, Greg Lay.
Hello.
James Jones.
Hey.
And special guest, Michael T.Y.P. Cole.
Hey, everyone.
Our good friend, returning champion, friend of the show, you might say. John Lindemann could not be here today, but he'll be back in a future episode, and
I like the ambiguity there, Johnny.
Like in the season finale.
Yeah, he was killed off by Doomsday. He will be returning once we figure out how to resolve the plot holes. But I forgot to introduce myself. I am your host, Jonathan Metz. You know that. We're all good. We're all friends here. And we usually start this show with something called New Business. You know, normally we talk about a bunch of freaking Xbox games and shit like that.
But today we're going to talk about other PS3 games. So there we go.
That's later.
Later.
Later. But we're actually going to kick this off with some very topical, exciting stuff, because James has had in his possession for the past few days a pretty major upcoming release. So James, it's funny to me that you've been playing Super Mario Galaxy 2. You must have gotten this literally a day or two after last week when we recorded, and you mentioned that Galaxy is one of the games that you don't seem to like as much as everybody else.
Now, to be clear, what was the description I used in the email? I don't start frothing at the mouth for Galaxy compared to other people.
I think that's fair.
Right, so like people were for Ikaruga before that came out. You know?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Are you frothing more at Super Mario Galaxy 2?
Well, I've played it now, so not quite, but
the frothing demand's already been fulfilled.
Yeah, I've already taken care of the frothing. The game itself is it fixes some of the issues I had with Galaxy.
You know, like or don't like Galaxy, I never really thought of it as a fixer-upper. So, I mean, be a little more specific here about what you're talking about.
It just streamlines some things that were in Galaxy. Like, there's no hub world. There's a level layout like Super Mario 3 world.
Really? I mean, I knew that they were doing a world map. I mean, do they have branching paths?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to caveat this as saying I have tried my very best not to learn a whole lot about this game, because I kind of want to have a fresh take on it. And it's very ironic that I'm now on this podcast getting it spoiled at the 11th hour.
I'm not going to talk about any specific levels or anything. I mean, they've discussed the world map in the past and mm-hmm. stuff.
Right. What I want to wrap my head around is, you know, a lot of the 3D Mario games have had this concept where you have one area where you have a lot of different missions that maybe open up certain areas within that larger area, but they're all basically in the same playground area.
Right.
Versus a lot of 2D Mario games where it just sort of been linear. You have a world and there are different distinct levels. And Mario Galaxy straddled that a little bit. I mean, there were some shared areas,
but it was much more
broken up, even on the same planet.
Right.
So is this Mario Galaxy 2 take it even further?
So Galaxy 2, the area in which you operate outside of a level, I can use the word spaceship, because technically the big giant castle you were on before was a spaceship too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was actually.
Your spaceship, only thing that happens is more stuff appears on it, like characters and things to do on there, but it itself doesn't get any bigger. It doesn't expand in places where you can go. It is what it is. And there's a single point from which is your jumping off point into all the levels.
Okay.
That's good, because one of my complaints actually about the first Galaxy is that you're basically choosing levels from a menu, but the menu is broken up into all these pieces and you have to traverse all over.
You have to run around, yeah.
Yes, you have to actively menu your menu.
Yeah. So
which has been the way it has been since Mario 64, but
yes,
it seemed more painful in Galaxy.
It seemed more sort of perfunctory, and so it was to the point where it's like, this is so trivial, why isn't it just a menu?
Right. I mean,
and that's pretty much what they've done with two.
In Mario 64, you could, you know, there was stuff to do in the castle besides just levels, and then in Sunshine, there was a little bit of stuff to do.
Mm, you could get 100 coins in Delfino
and there was a bunch of stuff.
There were shines in there too, weren't there?
Exactly. Lots of them.
You could throw on that that jetpack and basically skate all over the ocean.
That's right. But in Galaxy, you couldn't even die. I mean,
right.
So are there secret exits and levels now? I mean, like secondary.
No. It basically, if you get a star, you open up the next chain off of that. But my biggest issue with it is, whereas all the 3D Marios, they've had, you know, 4 or 5 stars in each section, this game many cases as two or three, which means that you don't get to see the whole world change like you did in some previous games.
But that means there's more levels, right?
There's a lot of levels.
Yeah. See, I mean, this is the big thing for me is that, you know, it's been in development for more than 2 years. I mean, probably pretty much 2 years because we know it was finished.
Well, I mean, effectively, we could say it's been in development for 5 years. But
even so, considering the technical foundations, the graphics, the core gameplay, and the concepts are all in place, so you didn't have to spend time on those at all.
Right.
What you demand to have taken place in that couple of years is just the most robust and broad level design that we've seen in a 3D Mario game. You know, there isn't any pressure on this to float the entire system or to make it out for a certain day or to do all this technically amazing. It's all about level design. It's all about, as well, like enemies and bosses, all that kind of stuff. And I guess do you see a discernible difference between this and the first one in that regard?
Not really. What I do see, it's true. What I do see is
straight.
There's more. There's more emphasis on 2D elements, and then the moving from 2D to 3D.
Right.
I think I'm noting the review, which will be out by the time anybody hears this, is that it's hard for me to quantify the exact difference in number of 2D and 3D elements, but but it physically feels like there's more 2D in this game than in its predecessor. And the 2D levels, I think Carl said last week that the 2D elements of Galaxy were his favorite 2D. They're really good in this game.
That sounds great.
There are some really good and really challenging 2D platforming sections in this game.
Cool.
There's some really good and challenging platforming 3D sections in this game, but there's also some really frustrating control-snapping 3D platforming sections.
So the 3D stuff's still, like, the more kind of frustrating, like, because I guess with 2D, it's always more straightforward, I guess.
Right, because you don't have to worry about, am I behind this platform or am I in front of it? I mean, I'm on it.
I mean, one thing I want to know about on that, going back to sort of the point we were making earlier, is the bosses. They repeated quite a lot in Galaxy 1. What's the deal here?
So, the non-world bosses, so in Galaxy it was Bowser.
Mm.
Bowser was a world boss versus the bosses for individual normal stars.
Right.
I can only think of one instance where there's a repeat.
Good.
Well, that's definitely a marked improvement then.
There could be more because I got like 92 stars in 36 hours. So
I mean, you were likely to run into the bosses like twice just to get to 60 or 80 in the galaxy.
But I mean, like my head was swimming by the time I finished that kind of marathoning. So it's quite possible that I might have. I'm going to go ahead and say that reviewing games does have a downside sometimes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Because right now I'm at 111.
Wow.
Like, I'm at that point where it's like, they're either secret stars I can't find, or they're the comets that make me want to snap the controller in half, which...
So they kept some of the mechanics that I feel are kind of watering down the experience, which are, you know, things like collect 100 coins or the equivalent.
Yes, they did.
I was very much of two minds with those in Galaxy, because there were ones that were really
good.
Some
were great.
And there were ones that were really bad.
And that's how it is here. There are some truly just awesome timed coin collections that they're usually referred to as collect 100 purple coins.
But do they have one that's like that B world where they have them scattered everywhere and
shoot me, shoot me before I ever do that again?
No,
Wario smack.
They're usually in line, so it's basically just a path of them you have to follow. But you may not have a lot of time to get to the end, or you may have to do some challenging platforming, or you're under attack. Something.
I'm cool with all that.
Yeah, that's fine.
Something's going on.
That's like
on.
A time trial.
They do a lot of... I'm trying to figure out how to say this, not really spoiling it. There's a lot of like rhythm stuff in there. It's not just the rhythm of the jump, but like things change based on a rhythm. So like the gravity directional change, or like floor panels will become active and inactive based on a rhythm. And there's one that actually sounds like a Rhythm Tengoku game.
That sounds
interesting.
And that level is maddening. But it's kind of like they try to make you do more in this game. It's definitely more challenging more often than Galaxy was.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously one of the things that really appeals to me, because I enjoyed Galaxy a hell of a lot, but it did kind of feel like once it got going, there was a sort of sweet spot in Galaxy for me. There was, after it got going, where it got really, really good. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the kind of the very last stars you're going for, some of those ones that are, you know, kind of recycling content a bit,
right,
or they're scavenger hunting, or that bit in the middle.
The ones you put off.
Yes.
Yeah, it's natural selection. I mean, those are at the end because they're your least favorite. You know? But in the middle part, it was just, I absolutely adored it. And I suppose what I'm saying is if this is more challenging, it kind of sounds like that middle part from the first game is much more of the sort of meat of it from the beginning.
And by default, it almost has to be because there's so few stars per galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I'm more excited than I was about this. I mean, you seem kind of ho-hum about this, James, because maybe that's just the way you always are. But
it's hard.
But I was, you know, when you mentioned that, you know, via email or whatever, that it's just more of the same, I was very worried that it was just, you know, it's going to kind of cheapen the experience. But it sounds like it really is, you know, here's more stuff that's really good.
Right. It is more of the same. And it's really good content. But so it's hard to kind of bring up talking points for it because it is still effectively the same game we all played a few years ago.
Okay, well, what about Yoshi? I mean, I don't want you to spoil everything, but I assume you cannot bring Yoshi into every level.
You cannot bring Yoshi into any level. You find Yoshi where he's needed.
Yeah, well, that's expected given that they didn't even do it in New Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, but is it much more prevalent than, I mean, Yoshi's on the box of both these new Mario games.
He comes up a lot. Of all of the new power-ups, he comes up 5 times more often than any of the other ones.
That's good.
Right, but he has his own power-ups, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. He has his own set of power-ups as well.
And the pointer stuff, with using his tongue and everything?
It's fine. It's absolutely fine. It's actually the best use of the pointer in the game, much so than any Starbit
stuff. Well, because it was trivial in the first
episode. Well, it's still trivial. It's still basically only there to feed Lumas, which really needs to go away.
Yeah.
Oh no, that's way too close.
Yikes.
Yeah, my biggest beef with the Lumas isn't them turning into new galaxies. It's within a galaxy when you're trying to get the secret stars where they pop up. That's still there.
Oh, you need two more star bits. Don't you wish you hadn't shot those? Oops.
Oh no, no, it's worse because it's coins. So if you've died at some point, you've lost all those coins from your checkpoint. So it's like, well, you would have been fine, but you died 3 checkpoints ago, so you're 4 coins short.
That's
weird.
That makes it more difficult. I mean, you could sort of game the system in the first game where you die a couple of times, then you have enough star bits.
Right,
so this just makes it much more challenging.
But the only problem is you have to know it's coming. You have to know there's a Luma ahead of you.
That is annoying, but then it does encourage you to play better when you revisit so that you can do it.
Yeah, and that's what I've had to do.
I think it's a smart choice.
Yeah, it's just kind of irksome, but it's like, all right, you get there and you're like, oh, damn it, he wanted me to collect coins the whole time. Great. So the last one of those I had to get, because I think I've gotten all the Hungry Luma stars at this point, I had to actually go forward a considerable distance in the level, get coins, and then blindly platform back since I can't turn the camera around to get the freaking star. Because I had lost coins.
Well, why am I getting shades of Sonic Adventure in my mind right now?
A little bit, yeah.
Please don't.
I guess one of the last things I've got to think about is the balance in the original galaxy. It was mostly these sort of quite linear levels, but, you know, going from planetoid to planetoid. Obviously, you said there's more 2D stuff, so straight away that's
right.
You know, more like that. But in terms of the, you know, in the first galaxy, you had, like, obviously, the B galaxy.
Right.
And you had, like, with the water slide galaxy stuff, the kind of more free roaming. I mean, has the balance in that aspect changed as well, thanks to the 2D stuff?
Not really, because what they did, and they did a pretty good job of this, is they'll integrate 2D stuff to 3D stuff pretty well. So it doesn't usually just go flip. It's like a subtle pan, and then all of a sudden you realize, I'm only moving in 2D right now. But there's extended periods of 2D that then turn back to 3D, or in some cases become 3D for the first time. There's an end world, so there's a bunch of worlds in the game, and in each world there's a series of galaxies, which is completely backwards, but that's the naming convention they used.
Yeah.
Well, they did use galaxy when they were talking about worlds in the first game, so they kind of screwed themselves over.
They did. It was like, well, that's great. So what I've got is there's the boss galaxies. There's one that does a whole long 2D section, I think, at the very beginning. And then all of a sudden it pans out to 3D, but it kind of has you doing the same thing in 3 dimensions now, which is kind of an interesting change. But most of the game now is the linear stuff. But there's a bunch of worlds that do have kind of mini-game aspects to them. Mostly good.
Blowing up trash?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. And you know
not
what?
Not good.
The second to last star I got was the last blowing up trash one, and it made me want to die.
Aren't we doing a good job of promoting how great this game is, guys?
We're not here to promote it, Mike. We're here to learn more about it.
You all are mentioning your concerns you had from Galaxy, and I'm telling you, this is Galaxy 2. I mean, it is. It is the most accurately named game in the history of gaming.
But, I mean, I guess the big takeaways from it is more 2D, more challenging, more variety.
Yeah, there is more variety. I can't remember how much there was in the way of motion-controlled minigames in the first game.
It was some. I mean, you had the point and stuff.
The pointer ones were really good, where you're flinging Mario around sort of
from star to star.
I thought that was one of my favorite parts of the game.
And then there was the monkey ball type thing as well.
That's what I'm thinking of. And then finally
there was the Manta Ray race bit.
Yeah.
Those were kind of the three
motion games. There's about three of them in this one with the motion controls, and surprisingly they're still kind of a bit dodgy. But, you know, the game itself, like I said, it's a lot of fun game. I mean, I gave it a 9.5. It's not like I hate the game. It didn't really do a whole lot to Galaxy. I mean, it did what it aimed to do, which was take a game that was already one of the best on Wii and say, all right, we'll make a few smart adjustments to it and put it back out with more stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fair that, you know, when a game is over 2 years in development, is using the same engine and all the same assets and everything, I think it's fair to expect that whatever few identifiable flaws there were in the first one should be addressed in the second one. So it sounds like some were, some weren't. And
right.
So I get it. But yeah, obviously we're starting from a baseline point here of, oh my God, Galaxy's really, really good. And the sequel is obviously more of that.
Right. And so it makes sense that the first questions that you guys want answers to are, did they fix this thing I didn't like about Galaxy?
It's pretty easy to identify the very, very small handful of things that we would want to change.
Right. It's really funny because there is a level in this game towards the end that is one of my favorite levels in a 3D Mario game of all time, just because it's so ridiculous that it's just really fun. And I remember after I left that level going, there is no way they're going to top this level for the rest of the game. And they proceeded not to. but I've gone back and played that level like 3 or 4 times, even though I've got everything in it, just because I really enjoy it.
Hmm. That's kind of how I felt with, like, what was it, Gusty Garden Galaxy? Or
yeah.
I mean, it kind of the same feeling where it's like, they just click, and like, I want to go back and play that.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine them making a level that, I mean, it was a hard level, too. It was one that, like, I got mad at, because it's just hard, but it's still really fun to play. There is, speaking of it being difficult, they did add the Super Guide, which they refer to for some reason, I don't know why, as the Galaxy Guide in this game.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's a funny reference.
I don't think they get that.
You have to die 42 times before it kicks in.
No. It's like 17. It really is. It's absolutely stupid how many times you have to die. But so I saw it once, and I used it because I was ready to break my TV, the Wii remote, and then fly to the address that was listed as the return address from the envelope I got and beat the person for making this level.
Wow.
So you got a bronze star for that?
Yes, you get a bronze star. It's the bronze star of shame. And then the comet, because the comets are back, and that is one thing that they did fix. The comets don't freaking move around.
Thank you.
They just pop up more of them, so they'll have like 4 or 5, or you can have like 4 or 5 active at the same time.
That's fine.
There's only one type of comet, so it's not like you have one comet here, one comet there, another type of comet over here.
That sounds like a massive improvement.
Yes.
It was just because it was putting barriers between you and the gameplay.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't get that really.
And most of the improvements they made to the game are really just taking down barriers between you playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean...
Mm. Yeah, which, I mean, I think in a Mario game is really what it should be.
Right.
You know, there's certain games where you could say, oh, well, you know, they're doing this, that, and the other because it's part of the experience, or it's trying to, you know, get you to play in a certain way. But Mario always is just about no-nonsense fun.
Right.
If that's not too much of a sort of oxymoron.
It takes considerably less time from turning on the Wii to getting into a level in 2 than it does in the original Galaxy.
So usability, it's all about usability.
Yeah, that's really what they did. They really went back and said, what about this game made it you know, hard to play, or made it, or were barriers between you playing it and finishing the game?
Well, it sounds like they lowered some barriers for you, James, because you were saying last week that you, in the first one, you really had no desire to go past the 70 stars to beat the game, and now you've already got 111 in the sequel. You've written the review, and you're still playing it.
I had written the review at 90. So I've packed on another 21 stars.
So that's a thumbs up.
Yeah, it is. But the story I was going to finish is that that particular level I got the awesome bronze star on, the comment for it was to play that level with a timer. I was like, oh. And if you die at all, you have to restart from the very beginning, not from the checkpoint that I had got the Galaxy Guide on. And somehow I actually won and got that one on the first try for some stroke of divine intervention, but I still can't freaking get the star in the original version without the timer.
You know, I never found the timers to really be a big deal in the first one. It was like I always completed it in time.
They usually aren't for the play the level timer. If it's other stuff like collect a bunch of coins in X amount of time or score a certain number of points in this amount of time, that can be really annoying. I won't spoil this character, but you'll know when you get there. There's a character that gives challenges to you that if we were getting the next Mario Party instead of the next Wii Party, he would be the master of ceremonies for that game. And he's going to start showing up in more games because he is so stupid. He's the dumbest looking character they've ever created. So I know they're going to love him. He even has big retro 80s sunglasses. Let's put it that way.
So they brought back Funky Kong?
Wow, you actually get really, really close in your description of him.
Awesome.
Oh, it's so weird. But he has a bunch of time challenges he gives you based on trying to chain together kills to get points.
So there is a point system in this game?
Well, there is in his stages. So it's like 100 points for killing, 200, 300, as you chain kills together.
That's a little retro.
Yeah, it is. There is a lot of ways you can earn stars in this game. There's not a lot of underwater stuff, actually, now that I think about it.
That was not awesome. Yeah.
There's like one galaxy that really heavily features swimming. It's only half of the stage is swimming.
You know, that's basically the way it was in all the other 2D Mario games. There was usually a couple of levels that are dedicated to swimming, and then it's kind of a trivial
right. And it's a trivial element in a few other stages, but there's really only one stage that really features swimming, and one of the stars on that level, I don't even think requires you get in the water. It's kind of silly.
I mean, it definitely seems like they've been informed, I think, by the success of New Super Mario Bros. On DS and Wii in terms of this whole usability angle.
Yeah, there is some serious New Super Mario Bros. Stuff that shows up in this game sometimes. Like, there are some stages where I'm like, this feels like a Bowser castle out of New Super Mario Bros. Didn't I play this level 6 months ago?
Well, those are all the best levels.
'Cause something like that, yeah. Like I said, it's Galaxy with some usability improvements and Yoshi. That's really what it comes down to.
You've got Yoshi. You've got Yoshi, and it's more challenging. So they pretty much checked off what I wanted out of a Galaxy sequel.
Yeah, it's basically Greg satisfied.
It's going to be a really long 3 weeks to wait before I can play this.
God, that's right. At least you're not in Australia.
It's like, compared to like the Brawl fiasco, it's like 3 weeks. Oh, that's quite good. But when it actually comes to it, it's like 21 whole days.
Oh, I know. But like I said, at least you're not in Australia, which July 1st is the release date. Oh,
is that right?
God, what the heck?
Well, you know, they got to localize the massive part that doesn't acknowledge the first one happened.
Well, I think we have to move on now to more important matters like Final Fantasy 13.
All right, I'll be back later.
Well, James, I really think you should play this game, actually, but I've been playing Final Fantasy 13, and I have to say it's because Johnny recommended it so highly on the show, a month ago?
Something like that, yeah.
And this is actually my first experience with a console Final Fantasy game.
Well, you've played console Final Fantasy games on handheld, right?
Like the re-releases? I played Final Fantasy IV for DS. This is the first post Final Fantasy VII console game I've played.
Right.
Okay.
And so I want to start the discussion by saying I think that everyone who kind of criticizes it, especially saying, oh, it's like a tutorial mode goes on forever, they're full of shit. I mean, they are full of shit because I'm convinced that they have such a myopic view of what this franchise is supposed to be, or what RPGs are supposed to be, or what a tutorial means, that they just can't see the game for what it is.
I think it's a really weird semantic argument over the definition of tutorial. I think some people have a really strange, warped view of what a tutorial is.
If I don't get my screw attack in Metroid until near the end of the game, that's when the tutorial ends.
Exactly.
I mean, that's exactly. kind of the argument I'm seeing them make.
Right.
In reality, the way this game works is there are two very distinct halves to the game. And the first half is very plot-driven, very character development, and kind of high-paced action. And then the second half is a little more laid back, more like you'd find another RPG. And to be frank, I like the first half of this game a hell of a lot more. I think it's much better paced. It does not drag on nearly as much as the second half, where there's a little more grinding or filler is the way I see it. Not that it's bad. I think it's still very well done. But at times, it's kind of overwhelming juggling your level ups and making sure that you are improving the right things. And in the beginning, it's really more of a, you know, how do you beat this battle without the resources you have available?
It's like sheer tactics.
It is. I mean, you know, at first, you don't see it, but eventually you realize, oh, I'm doing poorly against this boss, and if you change your tactics, you do much better. Like, when they first introduced the Sentinel role, when the Sentinel role is kind of a defensive role where the character absorbs attacks, kind of taunts the enemies, gets them to attack them, and absorbs attacks. And at first, I'm like, I don't want to use this. And then about, I don't know, 2 hours after they introduce it, you're forced into a scenario where, like, well, maybe I should give this a shot. Maybe if I try it this way, you know, this boss will be a lot easier. And it really does make you explore the game strategy. It really can make all the difference. And the interesting thing is, like, I don't know how far you are in the game, Johnny, but I found that I really didn't bother much with the equipment at all.
Yeah, the equipment, it's getting to the point where I'm not really sure why they put it in there anymore, because the experience levels are... I mean, you develop your character through experience. You know, you're choosing hit points and defense and offense and things like that. And so it just gets to the point where equipment, it seems to give just kind of bonus effects more than anything.
Right. And you can, like, lots of item drops, and you can use that to forge weapons and improve weapons and things like that.
But that system is really obtuse.
It is obtuse, and it's overly complex, but I found that...
And Square Enix made it, you say?
Well, no. At the very end, I hit a brick wall at the very last boss. Like, I cannot beat this. I cannot beat this. And I said, well, what can I do about this? And I realized I need to deal with equipment. It was... They forced me at the very end of the game to all of a sudden consider equipment in my strategy. And once I had accrued so much gil because I hadn't been buying anything. So I just purchased the best, whatever... plus 100 strength, plus 100 magic, and equipped those on all the characters I had in my party, and even in Chain 2 I had in my party, because I'd been neglecting some guys. And that made all the difference. I mean, seriously, it went from a, this is fucking impossible, to, oh, okay, I can do that.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a sign of a very interesting design. I mean, they really have an interesting battle system in this game, and I think it's very rewarding. And I found that I probably was not playing the game very smartly for most of the game. I was kind of scratching tooth and nail, barely beating every battle. And if I had explored the equipment a little more, I think it would have been a little easier for me. But I enjoyed the tooth and nail. I mean, it's very satisfying to beat a boss in the game.
You know, I think one thing we complain about a lot on this show is game series where all these different elements become really precious, and Nintendo is very bad about this, where they get this idea that certain things need to be in all of their games, when it really doesn't need to be. And and in their systems too, you know, they have friend codes and all that crap. And one thing I'll say about Final Fantasy is that really nothing about those main entries in the series is precious. They are willing to pretty much reinvent every single thing if they think it'll make it better. And yeah, some things get phased in and out over the course of multiple games, but they are a lot more revolutionary with what they do with that franchise than a lot of other publishers are.
Yeah, so I've been thoroughly satisfied with the game. And, you know, I pause when I purchase $60 games because I really don't do it much, but I do think I got my money's worth. And I am going back and replaying some of the missions that you can unlock. I will say that once it becomes less linear, the level design is kind of wonky. Johnny, have you gotten to Grand Pulse yet?
See, it's funny. I've mentioned that the PS3 is the only console I brought with me to Texas.
Just before Galaxy 2 came out, by the way.
Yeah, well, I think I can play it on my roommate's Wii a little bit, because I did buy a copy of it today, so I'm going to get it. I'm going to have it like 2 weeks before I can get back to my system.
Just to piss me off.
Yeah, exactly. But the PS3 is the only console I brought with me on this extended trip, and I was playing Final Fantasy literally like the day before I left, and somehow it, in all the packing, it got left at home. No. So I've been eagerly awaiting to get back to it as soon as
See, now you know what the Last Remnant feels like. There you go.
not quite. But no, to answer your question, I was stopped basically at the exact midpoint of the game where it changes over into the more open stuff that most people seem to prefer, that half of the game, the second part.
I think that it's different. I think I like the character development and the pacing of the first half a lot more. And you know, I don't know if it was last episode of RFN or the prior one, you were talking about storytelling and things like that. I don't think that this game has like the most original story or anything like that. But I think that at least for the first half of the game, it is very good at telling its story, and the characters are interesting and for the most part believable. I just think they do a really good job, and of course the high production values that, you know, there isn't this uncanny valley. It really does look like characters acting.
And I think there is true depth to some of those characters, which is not something you see very often. I mean, I think the plot itself is fairly simple, but the characters actually develop over time.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that kind of stops at that midpoint, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Because in the first half of the game, the way it's structured, characters are basically forced into teams that you kind of hop amongst as it progresses. And so they kind of have a camaraderie going on, and they'll be talking to each other, using their, you know, each other's names and saying, hey, thanks, Finial, for, you know, doing that. And you really feel like the characters are our team, and they're interacting with each other. And once it's opened up where you can choose any character, kind of just by design, some of that is lost. They aren't talking to each other as much. I mean, they do, but it's more generic, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was going to say about the design for Grand Pulse is that there's this large Hyrule field, I don't know what you want to call it. In the main game, you have to progress through like a cave and get to like kind of the other side of the world. And they do have warp points so that you can kind of shortcut later. But you need to find those, and if you aren't aware of that first warp point, like I wasn't, you then have to like hunt it down, or you have to traverse on foot the entire way. And I think it's really poor design. They really should have forced you to find that first warp point, because I wound up wasting a lot of time basically because I didn't know where the first warp point was, and I went on foot when I really should have been warping.
Good to know.
Yeah, but overall, I just think it's a really good package. I'm very impressed by it. I don't know if I would enjoy the earlier Final Fantasy console games, but this game, definitely, it's worth the money.
I'm very glad that you like it, considering you bought it based on something I said.
Well, I mean, basically before what you said, I had spent an afternoon with Kohler, Chris Kohler, who, of course, does not like the game and has made that pretty clear.
Yeah.
And he very strongly recommended I do not buy it, and I should hunt down a copy of Final Fantasy VI for GBA instead.
I'm not going to argue with him about that one, but...
No, I think I should still do that. But the point is, I think that he falls into this camp of having a preconception as to what the game should be. And, I mean, if you take it for what it is, if it weren't called Final Fantasy, I mean, it wouldn't sell as well. But, I think a lot more people would be open to what the game is.
Maybe so, but I mean, he played the whole game. If he didn't have fun, he didn't have fun. So I'm not going to argue with him about that. I definitely see why it's polarizing, you know.
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me at all from what I've played of it so far. But yeah, I'm glad you like it though. That's really good to hear. So Greg, I know you and I have both been playing 3D Dot Game Heroes, and John too. He couldn't be here, obviously, but when he gets back, he will be addressing this as well. But why don't you kick off the discussion of this one, and I'll chime in when appropriate.
Yeah, sure. Well, I finished it today, or at least one of the endings. I think there's more than one, depending on if you do certain things. But you know, I've seen the game basically, and you know, obviously it is a knockoff of old school Zelda. I mean, Jeremy Parrish has referred to it as sort of the Zelda 2 that never was, in terms of it's an intermediate step between the original Legend of Zelda and Link to the Past.
That's very astute,
And I agree with that, even though I haven't played like the first Legend of Zelda to completion to sort of have the most familiarity with that. But you could still see what he means by it, and I agree with it from the point of view that there's certainly a number of the trappings of something like Link to the Past over the first one, in terms of some of the items, like you pretty much got, you know, the Pegasus boots and the hookshot and, you know, some of the sort of later items that came in.
When you have towns and things like that too, a lot more side quests.
Yeah, and it's linear. You know, you attack the dungeons in a specific order, mm-hmm. Which I mean, Link to the Past wasn't completely rigid in that regard. There were some that you could do in a different order. Although you could also say that of Ocarina of Time. I think Spirit and Shadow Temple you could do one right. or the other yeah. first. So, but obviously with the original Legend of Zelda, that had a lot of flexibility about what you could do.
I would say it lacked structure on what you should be doing.
Yes.
Yeah, well,
yeah, that's
I
a better agree, way of putting James. It.
It wasn't so much flexibility as it was lack of structure.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's absolutely right. And that's the thing. This is far more structured. You know, so, but at the same time, it's definitely not as sophisticated as A Link to the Past, primarily in the area of dungeon design. Yeah, there's basically seven dungeons in the game, although really there's six that are sort of really unique. The seventh one is kind of, surprise, what you often get in Zelda, where it's not like a traditional dungeon. It's kind of more of a gauntlet of things.
Yeah.
So you've got six dungeons proper. And I'd say that the first two are very straightforward, as you might expect, really. But that's, you know, that's a third of them. And then so then you've got a really kind of four dungeon once it really gets going. And the thing about them is that compared to A Link to the Past, they're certainly not as clever. But there's insufficient dynamism for me in the sense that you get new weapons and new objects and items and all this kind of stuff. But the gameplay doesn't change all that much according to those. Mm-hmm. It still generally tends to be the same sort of stuff with your activating switches and pushing blocks. It certainly becomes more difficult from a point of view of like enemies that you'll encounter, and also the dungeon maps become very much more intricate, much more maze-like, with more interconnections between multiple floors and all this, and far more confusing and far more difficult and bigger. But in terms of the actual puzzle solving, it doesn't actually change very much.
We really shouldn't be surprised. I mean, this is the core part of Zelda, is the dungeon design. Like, that's the, you know, the seed of every Zelda game. And it's got to be the hardest part to do. I'm sure that's where they start. Every Zelda game starts with some dungeon ideas, and they just bloom it out from there. But it's not surprising that a company like From Software or whatever, whoever the developer was,
Silicon Studio.
Yeah. It's not surprising to me that they would go after basically making their own Zelda game or their tribute to Zelda with such great zeal and do a really good job of it in most accounts, and fall a little bit short on the dungeon design, because mm-hmm. that's where Nintendo really has the expertise that almost no one else does.
I mean, so it would seem. I mean, I still enjoyed the dungeons, actually, but they're just not all that different. You know, I mean, like normally, you know, especially I've mentioned before, you know, sort of like Twilight Princess, you know, some of those dungeons are so, so different from each other.
Yeah.
Structurally, the gameplay in terms of, you know, using items and stuff, whereas obviously you're going all the way back to 2D and all this, and of course there's not a lot of visual variety, you know, with the dungeons and all this sort of stuff either. They are quite straightforward, but still solid. But a bit more sort of workmanlike than the kind of inspiration that seemingly Nintendo manages to get with the dungeon design. But the thing that it really packs, where the kind of the nostalgia of Link to the Past kicks into me, is the overworld stuff, mm-hmm. because that's what's disappeared from modern Zelda games, including the portable ones, because they've, you know, with the 3D graphics and everything,
yeah.
you know, basically, you know, Wind Waker, I didn't like the overworld stuff there because it was very reductionist, obviously.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yes, they reduced the amount of stuff in it.
It's not that great in Minish Cap either, which is the last 2D Zelda game.
Well, yeah, I guess you could put it that way. I mean,
it's a lot closer to A Link to the Past. So I benefit a lot from having that there. I, you know, I mean, I'm not a big exploration guy in Zelda, if you know what I mean. I'm more about the dungeons in terms of what I really get out of it, what I love about it the most. But the making the exploration much more sort of substantive to me with the kind of more intricate overworlds makes it a much more pleasurable part of the experience.
Yeah, I'm the same way, Greg.
Yeah, and I think here you have got some interesting overworld design stuff, you know, quite sort of maze-like in itself at times. So it does feel like you are really kind of accomplishing something once you get to certain locations rather than it was merely the passage of time. And so, given that it has been, you know, since Minish Cap, or, you know, for people that might not have played or enjoyed that one, or that, you know, arguably going farther back, you know, perhaps to the Game Boy Color ones or Link's Awakening or whatever, yeah. I think that's really what's done it for me with this one. And it is an element of Zelda that I miss personally. So yeah. That was scratching an itch, I'd say.
I agree. And I don't think there's been a really great Zelda overworld since Link's Awakening. And, you know, I love the one in Link to the Past as well. And I kind of like the one in Zelda 2, although it's a very different sort of thing.
The Link's Awakening one, though, is kind of weird because it doesn't have a lot of area variety. It's pretty small, I mean, in terms of real estate space.
But every screen in that game is full of things going on.
Yeah, it's true. That's definitely
true. There's no
true,
wasted space in Link's Awakening. I mean, just looking for the seashells alone is
there can't be
fantastic.
Because there's not that much of it. No, they couldn't afford to really waste anything. I mean,
it's just tight.
What was more interesting for me in that particular game is that there are events tied to the different places in it that, in some cases, you might even miss if you just don't explore them at the right times.
Mm, yeah.
So every place there this doesn't necessarily have something to find, but it has a purpose as well in terms of both story or event driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, going back to 3D.GameHeroes, I mean, I do like the sword stuff. There's, you know, there definitely feels like there's quite a lot more to it in terms of, like, there's a lot of swords to find. I mean, I haven't found hardly any of them. There's an enormous quantity of swords. And there are sort of, you know, meaningful sort of differences between them. First of all, just in terms of the dimensions of them. You could get sort of like long swords that are quite weak inherently, although you can spend money to upgrade them and in fact make them bigger and wider and all, you know, very customizable. And then on the other hand, you might have like a short sword, like a gladius or whatever, that's really powerful, but of course, because it's so short, you kind of have to put yourself in harm's way to use it. So that element is kind of cool, and kind of customizing your sword and all that. And the biggest thing is you've got that sort of that spin ability, they call it, where you can kind of attack in the one direction but then sweep around in a kind of quarter circle. And I mean, if you've got the screen filling sword with and like the pierce ability, which allows it to go through the scenery, you can just kill an entire screen of monsters in one sweep.
That's almost a special ability, though. I mean, that's not something you can do
It is. Well, you got to have full health. It's sort of like the beam sword on incredible amounts of steroids.
it's beyond the beam sword.
Yes.
And but the thing about it, I would say, in certain instances, as cool as that is, it's kind of, it is overpowered. It is really unbalanced. I mean, clearly it's unbalanced. I mean, it's like you take a half of a heart or apple, but you know what I mean, away, and then you've gone from just killing everything at will to suddenly, you know, finding it really difficult. So that's a bit extreme, and I suppose, you know, appropriately old school kind of thing.
I mean, this is interesting. The swords are various lengths and different characteristics. I mean, when I think of a Zelda game, generally speaking, you know, everything is pretty rigid. I mean, the sword is always a certain length, and that plays into the combat design and you know, how far away the enemies are from you. And it seems like you can't build that into the game if now you have this dynamic sword structure.
And in fact, that's kind of why in Ocarina of Time, the Bigoron sword just didn't really seem like much of an advantage, because the game system really wasn't built to handle it.
But this is so different from Ocarina of Time. I mean, if you think back to the original Legend of Zelda, the enemies basically move in random paths. And so
more or less,
having
yeah.
a longer sword can be really helpful because it lets you yeah. stay far, because you don't know where they're going. I mean, they're almost like zombies, you know, they just kind of wander around. If they bump into you, they take off a lot of life. So it's nice to be able to keep your distance, you know, and to use little things mm-hmm. like the spin to keep you out of harm's way. And what I like about the sword play is that it finds this weird middle ground, again, between Zelda 1 and Zelda 3. Because in Zelda 1, Link would just shoot his sword out straight in front of him, you know. And then in Zelda 3, Link to the Past, he's swinging in an arc. And you kind of have to get mm-hmm. a feel for that. And eventually you learn that you can sort of approach enemies from a certain corner. And that way you can hit them such that they don't really have a chance to hit you, right?
Yeah.
And 3D Dot Game Heroes basically lets you do both, depending on the situation or your skill level. It's really good stuff.
I think it's really good and a good sort of distinguishing feature of the gameplay. And certainly, like I said, where you get into some of these later dungeons where kind of a lot of what you're doing is dealing with these, you know, enemies and stuff, it's crucial that it's, you know, that part of the game holds up quite well to that sort of stress that they put on it. But I suppose the only complaint I have with the sort of mega power sword is just like sometimes if you're in a boss fight, which are very much, you know, old school and not like the modern Zelda do it three times or whatever, I mean, this is just keep bashing it until it dies,
yeah.
you know, and he'll be bashing away for quite a while in some cases. But it's a case of, well, if you can just avoid getting hit once, the boss is going to be piss easy. But then after that, it's really hard because all of a sudden your attack range is shrunk down to this little nub.
Well, you have health items you can use. I mean, there's a
yeah. I mean, you've got bottles exactly the same. I actually yeah. found four bottles like really quickly for some reason. I don't know. Like, I had hardly any of the swords, but I had all of the bottles. It was kind of strange. Like, I always remember in Link to the Past, like the fourth bottle was one of the last mm-hmm. things I ever got.
Yeah.
In the whole game, like, of all the items in it, so that was kind of weird. But yeah, I mean, you could just top up your health straight away if you have a health to get that massive sword back. But in that way, I mean, you could probably really brute force some of these bosses if you wanted to do it like that and do away with them pretty quickly.
I'm sure you could.
I don't know whether they might have been like a middle ground in terms of maybe like the first couple of hits the sword kind of shrinks gradually, or it's not quite as mega powerful, but it is part of the sort of old school kind of
yeah
charm.
I think you're overthinking it when you get to that level
I guess so.
I guess the
one disappointment I had was just that some of the items that you get are kind of feel a bit like glorified keys.
Oh, the grapple hook is I'm only halfway through the game and I just got the grappling hook or the hook shot, and clearly it's extremely useful, especially in the overworld, the way the overworld is designed to let you get from yeah. one place to another quickly. But man, that has got to be like the lamest grappling hook of any video game I've ever seen. It just kind of squirts out there. I'm not even sure that it makes a sound effect. It's really poor. Like, it just doesn't look good. It doesn't feel right.
But I mean, later on in the game, there's a fire wand that you get, mm-hmm. and I don't know, I haven't experimented with it that much just because it doesn't really seem like the kind of game where like lots of the items have different kind of applications. But in this case, it really did just seem like, oh, okay, so the fire wand, you use it to burn down these sort of old dead trees that are obstacles, and then that's it. That's it. It's literally like, well, if you want to get in the one dungeon, you've got to burn down this tree to get yeah. there. And you get this. And to the extent that the fire wand, all right, this is sort of spoilery stuff. So, you know, if you want to skip ahead or whatever briefly, you could do so now. But the fire wand is in a dungeon where you can complete the dungeon without getting it.
Uh-oh. Is it mandatory at other places?
And you have to have it later in the game. Oh, so I actually had to go back into the dungeon.
And you might not even know it was there, right?
It really is like the first Zelda.
Yeah,
it is old school. Like, you know, so I had to. The thing is these dungeons, like the way they're constructed, they're quite sort of labyrinthine, but at the same time linear. If that makes any sense, from the point of view that it kind of all makes sense when you're going on this progression through it the first time. Mm-hmm. But if you come back and it's like, I want to go here. Why is the quickest way to get there? You're like, it's really difficult to like cut into that line that you made the first time somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. because you've already got the keys and everything.
It was all carefully done the first time, and obviously you were zigzagging across here and there. And like I said, sometimes how it all interconnects is quite complicated. Like, well, there isn't a stairs there, but there is somewhere where you can drop through the floor, and all the, oh, there is stairs, but actually there's blocks that block it off, so you can't use that. And I was, so if you're cutting into the middle of that, it's quite difficult. So going back there and getting that, you know, that was kind of a chore. And just because you'd think, you know, these days, you know, the idea that there'd be an item in a Zelda dungeon and you wouldn't use it in that dungeon is ridiculous. Like, that would never happen. So it is very old school in that way. But like I said, the bigger problem I had with it is just that even after that, you're okay, it doesn't do anything in that dungeon, fine. But even after that, it's a key. I mean, that's what it is. So, and that in that way, you know, these items don't contribute that much to the gameplay as it goes on. And that's why it isn't that dynamic, because you just don't really gain that many meaningful abilities.
But you get different swords, and there's a few other things that change as you go.
Guys, is there a guy that says grumble, grumble, grumble?
I'm not sure. There is a guy who says it's a secret to everybody and he gives you 100 coins.
All right. Yeah. That's good. But my point is, is there a point where, like, you can't progress and you're like, how the hell am I supposed to know what to do here?
Oh, no, I don't think
if you didn't get the fire wand.
No, apart from that issue that I mentioned, which I guess the moral of the story is just be really thorough in the dungeons the first time. Like, go in every damn room. Although it's not actually possible to go in every room the first time through, because there's these colored doors that need special keys that you have to get from elsewhere, but obviously they're marked, so you know you're all right not to go in them, because you can't go in there yet.
There's certain places you have to come back later in the game.
Everything else, go there.
So, I haven't played as much as Greg, but I think my only real complaint about 3D Dot Game Heroes so far is that it's a PS3 exclusive, and it doesn't bother me that much because I have a PS3, obviously, but I do feel like this is a game that a lot of Nintendo fans are going to want to play, and there's not really a strong argument for it to be a PS3 exclusive. I mean, I will say that the visual style is utterly charming. I mean, I think it looks fantastic, and it really, playing the game and just looking at the world puts a smile on my face. So, I mean,
the presentation is a huge part of the enjoyment here.
It is. I mean, that alone is worth getting the game and playing it just to experience the visual style, because it's so good. But I feel like a scaled down version of that would have been almost as effective, and you could have done it on DS, much less Wii. I mean, I would love to see a spin-off of this or a sequel or something for DS. I think it would be perfect.
3DS, you know it.
That's right. It's all going to be in 3D. It's called 3D Dot Heroes, 3D Dot Game Heroes 3D.
Greg, I don't know if this struck you, but it feels weird to sit down and play NES Zelda on a PS3 controller.
It is odd, yeah.
It just feels like a mismatch of game with platform. Obviously, I have nothing against PS3, but I do feel like this could have been at least a multi-platform release with Xbox or something, but I feel like a Wii version is completely within reason. All you'd have to do is maybe put less of those pixel blocks in each character.
Yeah, I mean, the big it does start to chug a little bit when you kill a bunch of enemies at once.
It does. I feel like it's maybe just bad programming or something. Maybe the engine's just not very efficient.
It doesn't really affect the gameplay too much, but yeah, it does because everything disintegrates into the individual blocks, and
And that effect really, I don't think it's worth the performance hit that they're taking. Anyway, I just feel like I think this game would have really worked extremely well on the Wii or even the DS. So
no, I mean, and of course it is just, I mean, you know, in terms of what target audience it's going for, I mean, this is nakedly going after the Zelda audience. So,
right,
I mean, there's from a business point of view, it's puzzling. It seems weird, doesn't it? Because, you know, if it was on a Nintendo system, at least, you know, their naked sort of thievery of Nintendo stuff would be making Nintendo some money. And now they're doing it. You think Nintendo would be more likely to sort of drop some sort of legal hammer or something.
So, can we sue for this?
If I tell you what, it's getting close.
Yeah, no.
I was going about Darksiders, but this is much more sort of one to one.
The only problem for this is that Greg's now run out of recent Zelda clones. And
yeah, if Zelda Wii comes out this year, it'll be my third Zelda game this year.
First one called Zelda. So I will take a turn here with another PS3 game. This one's not quite as applicable to the Nintendo audience, I don't think. But
so skip ahead to the next chapter.
I think it's an interesting game. I think people will like hearing about it, especially based on all the emails that we get about things like this. But it's Heavy Rain, and I've been playing it for a few weeks now. It's a game that I don't play every day. I feel like, I don't know, I come to it and then I go play something else for a while and then I come back to it. And I've been traveling a lot too. But I do like it. It's very much the successor to Indigo Prophecy, which we've talked about before on the show. And I would be a lot more perplexed by Heavy Rain and just the way that it's put together if I hadn't played Indigo Prophecy. Right. Because I have that experience, I kind of know what to expect. I mean, this is Heavy Rain's a lot more sophisticated, obviously a totally different level of production values and everything, but in a lot of ways it's very similar. It's clearly, you know, the guys are just kind of expanding their ideas. And it's a very story heavy game. I mean, we talked last week about storytelling and, you know, things like that, convergence with Hollywood, etc. Mm-hmm. And this is a really interesting case study. Because in a way it's more movie-like than many other games, and yet in another way it's a lot more interactive than something like Metal Gear Solid 4, which just shows you movies, basically.
Yeah.
Whereas Heavy Rain, that's the entire game. I mean, there is no like core gameplay. There are no gunfights to fill in the spaces between cutscenes. The game is a cutscene. But it's a very interactive cutscene, very interactive. And not only, it's not interactive in that it feels like you're playing puppets, you know, you have lots and lots and lots of choices that you can make. I mean, it's a bit like a choose-your-own-adventure kind of thing where you have all these decisions, and a lot of times it'll be mundane stuff like, you know, do you go over here and make some food, or do you go over there and watch TV, or do you go over here and like work
food making games,
work on a drawing?
It really does sound like a choose your own adventure game.
Yeah, but I mean, each one of those three might lead to a very different result down the road, and you have no way of knowing. And it's not about trying to predict what will happen; it's about doing whatever your intuition tells you you want to do. It just becomes to the point where it's not like there's a good action and an evil action. There's just multiple actions that you can take. And so it's not about trying to choose the one that you think you should be doing. It's about just doing the one that you want to do. And it lets you sort of develop your own story based on your own preferences about what these characters should be like. And the other thing is you play as several different characters. Sometimes the scenes are set up really in an interesting way where you might be playing one character, they run into another character, they interact for a little while, then the first one leaves, and now you're controlling the second character. And it's just seamless. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like that. And the game doesn't comment on that at all. I mean, there's no attempt to explain why you're, you know, shifting perspectives all the time. But I mean, Indigo Prophecy did this as well, and there's a nice parallel with that game because there are points in Heavy Rain as well where you're basically playing both sides against each other. And it's not necessarily clear which one should prevail in the end, you know, morally or whatever. And it's not necessarily that, you know, I want one side to win and the other to lose. I want them both to win. And yet, by playing them both to what I think will be a successful conclusion, eventually they're going to come into conflict and one's going to win out over the other. But I have no idea what's going to happen when that comes. So there's some interesting dynamics.
Is it feel rigid, or is it, I mean, are they do a really good job of making it feel like all these different potential decisions and outcomes are seamless? I mean, because I can certainly see a situation where it's implemented kind of crudely and things are maybe inconsistent with each other down the road.
You don't want it to seem binary. I think that's the main thing.
I don't think it's binary, but it's one of those things where, because I haven't even played the game to completion once, much less multiple times, I don't know how different the things are. I've heard through the grapevine that there are some drastically different outcomes you can get all along the way, not just like two different endings, which is kind of what Indigo Prophecy came down to. But, I mean, there are playable characters who you can get killed off early in the game. Or, you know, if you do things differently, you might be playing as them right up until the end. So not only will you end up with different outcomes, but you might take very different paths to get there. You might play entire chapters that, you know, other people might not even know exist. So it seems like there are a lot of variations along the way. And again, they're not, there's not necessarily a good way to play it and a wrong way to play it. It's every way is valid. And that's why the creator was saying that David Cage, I think he was quoted somewhere as saying he kind of hopes that people don't play it multiple times to try to see every permutation.
Just play it once and play it your way.
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't think they put all this stuff in there explicitly for replay value. It can be used that way. That's fine. If I'm renting the game, if I had bought it, maybe I would want to play it more than once to see all the different possibilities. But as it is, I feel like it's more of a framework of a story where I get to have some control. I get to have some say into how it actually plays out. But at the same time, I'm continually surprised by what happens. You can't help but be, because it's a fairly ludicrous story in a lot of ways. There's a lot of crazy shit that happens. So there's no way you can see all of it coming.
Joe and Icky's going to barge through the room.
The story itself, I know, has been sort of controversial. You know, we got an email about this who kind of said that the story could have been written by a 12-year-old or something.
That's right, yeah.
I think that's a gross exaggeration. It's not Shakespeare, okay? It is a much better story than we usually get in games. Now, I know that sounds like a backhanded compliment, but
that was kind of the point of the email, wasn't it?
I try to avoid hyperbole, so I'm going to say that it is a good story. There are a lot of things I like about it. There are some plot holes and some character developments that I don't necessarily agree with.
Stories that are not completely sort of rigorous and comprehensive or a bit ridiculous, they can still be enjoyable, you know, sort of mm-hmm. a good yarn, but I suppose you are dealing with sort of dark subject matter here.
It's really dark. It's really dark.
Yeah. I'm just a little worried about the kind of juxtaposition of maybe some wacky stuff with this really gritty stuff. Like that's...
It's not that wacky. You know, I mean, there's a part of the game where you shave your face. You know, there's a part where you take a shower. There's some mundane things, but they're not played for laughs at all. They're meant to catch. They're more of establishing shots. They're right. kind of meant to just make you feel like you are this character, and that, you know, they do these things to let you get attached to the character and feel like you're you know, have a greater involvement. And then they start throwing like the emotional scenes at you. I don't know if that works as well as they were hoping, but I get it.
I think the biggest thing that resonates with me in terms of the criticism of this game is in terms of whether I would buy it or not, is the voice acting. Now, I haven't heard it, so I don't know. I'm wondering what you think of it, Johnny. What?
It's very inconsistent. A lot of it's pretty good. Especially knowing that they didn't really have any American voice actors. I think... There are one or two minor characters who must have been, they must have found some expatriate in Paris to do it, because there's no way these are French actors. But the main characters are all definitely Europeans trying to do American accents. And, I mean...
doesn't generally tend to work out well. If he's from the Southern Hemisphere, you can pull it off. You know,
Australians nail it every time.
Europeans generally not so much.
and you know, there's a wide variety of American accents. Some of these characters seem to be going for like a Boston kind of Northeast New England type of accent. And
right.
usually what happens is there are certain scenes where I feel like it works really well, and they totally sound authentic. And then there'll be another scene where throughout the entire scene, it doesn't work at all.
I remember when I was playing the demo, which is, you know, fairly brief, but it was with a portly private detective was going around to see the prostitute.
He's one of the best.
But the way the prostitute said weird shit, it was just like so French. Yeah. I was like, that totally took me out of it.
Yeah, she's one of the worst. The detective is one of the best, and she's one of the worst.
In some ways, that's sort of the worst part of it. His voice was good, and then hers was really bad, right. So that kind of inconsistency was jarring.
Are you suggesting you'd almost rather they all be bad or good?
Well, it's sort of some sort of alternate sort of reality where, I don't know, the French colonized America first or something.
And there are... there are aspects of the story, and a lot of times just little details about the way people's apartments are decorated or the way they'll say certain phrases to each other, where I think, man, maybe you should have written a story set in France, because I yeah. don't think David Cage understands America and Americans as well as he thinks he does.
Right, you know, it's kind of like the scenario where, like, Earthbound or something like that, where it's supposedly set in sort of America, but then there are these really Japanese facets to them.
That's the thing, you see, I think, especially being in Europe, there's something really charming when you're the thought of the third party of, like, Japan fawning over America and getting this weird right. Japanese funhouse mirror of it. And yeah. that's really funny. Whereas when, like, it's Europeans, kind of like, oh, this inferiority complex. Yeah, what? Like, ugh. Yeah. My self-esteem's dropping as I'm listening to
It's almost more excusable when the Japanese really screw it up, because they have created this weird pop culture version of America in
yeah,
their head.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all their own. I mean, they're not even really portraying America anymore. They're portraying this creation they've made. But whereas with something like this, it's someone trying to seriously portray America.
Yeah, so it's like it's meant to be a kind of recreation. It just seems weird to me. Clearly a tremendous amount of effort and love and work went into this, you know, with the performance capture stuff they did, all the time, you know, it must have been a huge amount of work. It just seems to me almost self-destructive to so casually sort of say, well, no, we can't really do anything about the voice actors, or the, you know, we're going to end up with this sort of level of inauthenticity. Which is yeah. sort of self-inflicted. On one hand, you're sort of trying to climb the kind of technological mountain to get to a level of authenticity that there's never been before. And on the other hand, you're just shooting yourself in the foot with the voice actor. I don't get it.
What it proves is that the Uncanny Valley goes beyond visuals. It really comes down to the... I mean, you know, and it is performance capture. I would say if Avatar had not come out before this game would be blowing people's minds a lot more than it is. Because, I mean, it does have all this performance capture. You can see the play in people's faces and the way that they, you know, move their hands and the way they walk around is very natural. It's really impressive stuff that you haven't really seen in other games, except maybe Uncharted 2, which use some of the same technology. It's really impressive stuff, and it helps the storytelling a lot, because it is a story meant to be taken seriously. I mean, you know, one of our biggest complaints about Indigo Prophecy is the story gets totally ludicrous after a while, where there's these action scenes where you're like dodging ghosts and laser beams. I mean, it just goes off the rails. It's completely fucked up by the end. But it is meant to be very realistic. It's meant to be taken very seriously. And I think that's a noble effort. And I think they've come closer than almost any other game I've ever played. But the Uncanny Valley really creeps in, because the graphics are so good. The technology is so good that these things like the voice acting... And I mean, you know, the game is all voice acting. It's crucial. Interactive cutscene. The voice acting is a huge part of the game, and we'll talk about this later. But you either have to do it right or not at all. But anyway, I'll wrap up. But I am enjoying Heavy Rain. I think it's a game that, if you have any curiosity about it, you should give it a try. I don't feel qualified to recommend that people buy it or not. I don't even know how close I am to finishing it. But I do think it is a unique experience so far. I think there will be more games like it. I think it is... I've been using this term literally lately, but I think it's kind of a bridge title between the way games have been done so far and the way that they might go in the future. So it's not there yet, but if you kind of want to see a glimpse of what's to come, maybe, I think it's really interesting. And I've enjoyed it a lot, despite a lot of observations and, you know, kind of complaints about it. I think it's compelling stuff. It's worth trying out. So before we wrap up new business, Mike here was recently at a Konami press event, and I thought we would get a brief rundown on what you're allowed to talk about.
Well, that's real brief, because there's only one game I can really talk about, and it's Def Jam.
Rapstar?
Thank you, Rapstar. Shows you how much into this game I am. Unfortunately, I wish John were here because he probably actually cares about this game.
John would probably start rapping along with it. I don't know.
I wish John had been at the event and that we had videos of that.
Yeah, that would have been good. I mean, it's a music game. It's basically karaoke for hip-hop, pretty much entirely rap. So if you like rap songs, you get this game. If you don't like rap, don't get this game. But what they do basically is they have the music video playing and you're rapping to it. And you can turn, it's nice that you can turn the master track or the vocals on or off. Hmm. Also, they have an interesting feature. You can play short or long versions of the song too. So that seems pretty handy if you don't want a long session or you want to hand it off between friends, because I could see some of these songs getting pretty long or repetitive, but I don't like rap, so.
And it's rated M, right? Like it's uncensored, isn't it?
No, it's the radio version of the songs. They made that clear. They're going for
dude,
a T.
That, what a missed opportunity.
And the videos are censored too. I saw that.
Oh, man. Zero interest in this game now. I mean, I didn't have much before, but forget it.
Well, maybe they'll do an AO version on PC.
What the hell?
Hey, I don't know. That's what they said. That's what they told me. And actually, the Wii version is a little gimped because one of the features is that you can record yourself and then do some video editing, whatever, add effects and stuff, and post it online to their community board. But I don't know how big a deal that is anyway, because it's only a 30-second clip.
You can only record 30-second clip for you?
So it records the entire thing when you are doing a song, and then you can choose a 30-second segment that you like the most.
And it records your actual voice.
Well, it records your voice in your video. It's using the camera.
Well, but there is no camera on the Wii, unless you talk about the Jenny McCarthy thing.
Exactly. That's why the Wii version doesn't have this.
Okay.
Oh.
But they will have DLC for the Wii.
They should let you connect wirelessly your DSi to the system and use that.
Oh, there you go.
Wow.
You get Photo Dojo quality video.
So if you own a Wii and a DSi and you like hip hop,
your name is John Lindemann.
Then your name is John Lindemann, exactly.
Yeah, pretty much it. We've identified the one on the face of the earth.
Yeah. So obviously the market's not for me. I appreciate the attempt. I do agree that maybe they should have gone for the M. I don't know how many more sales they're hoping to get by making it teen.
Yeah, teenagers don't listen to rap.
Well, it's just for those mothers that are on the fence. You know, yeah, I want to buy this. I want to buy this for my kid, but is it a bit too much? No, it's teen. It's okay. It's okay. I can buy it.
But clearly they're incorporating some stuff from other prominent music games. They have a mode where you don't get booted off if you're doing poorly, so you can rap crap like crap and just get a bad rating.
Mm-hmm. Rap like crap.
and there's also a mode where I guess they have some unique tracks that they're getting their Def Jam celebrities to work on that don't have vocals. The idea is these are new tracks that you can do your own rhymes over.
Oh, you can freestyle on.
You can freestyle. It's freestyle mode.
I cannot freestyle. I've never been able to, but I have a couple of friends from back home, and they love to do that. They would roll around in their car. This is when they were teenagers. You know, they didn't have anything to do, and they had just gotten their driver's license, and their favorite thing to do was to roll around town in the car with some beat tracks on and freestyle. So these...
Oh, my God.
These two white kids from Alabama... I mean, this luckily they were in their car, so they're not in public exactly.
I'm sure some people would consider that the death of civilization.
It was the death of hip hop, but I mean, you know, we all knew that anyway.
Yeah, I guess the other interesting feature, and that's what they say. I don't know how good a job it does of this, but so in most games where they're rating your music, how well you sing. It's mostly listening to the pitch. Mm-hmm. You know, it usually doesn't give a shit about the actual vocals. And that wouldn't work very well for hip-hop. So what they're trying to do is develop an engine where it listens to the words you say and tries to determine whether you're actually saying the right words at the right time.
Sounds sketchy.
Oh, that's going to end badly.
Well, I agree. It may not. I don't know how well implemented it is, but in theory, that, I mean, come on, it's hip hop. There often isn't any tone at all. So what would they be ranking you on?
Oh, I understand.
It seems like it should be about the meter. I mean, it's the flow, right? It's not so much about the specific words that you say. It should at least listen for certain like rhyming sounds, right? Like the ends of lines.
Yeah, and it might. I don't know. They're listening to the rhythm, basically, mostly the rhythm and the syllables. But the way it was described is we have a reference track that it listens to, and that worries me because people have different voices, and if they're using one reference track, that's what he said. Maybe, you know, down in the metal, they're actually doing more. I don't know.
But if the reference track isn't based on pitch, then maybe the variation in people's voices won't matter as much. I do wonder if it'll be difficult with like accents and things like that, where people have slightly different pronunciations of different phonetic sounds, you know?
Yeah, I think they rank the two things separately when they score you, so you could at least see. If you were someone who had an accent and it wasn't registering properly, you could still have fun seeing how well you did with the rhythm.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting project at least, so I look forward to seeing 30-second clips of John Lindemann.
Oh, I do not look forward to that at all.
And as for the rest of the games you saw, I guess we will have to wait till E3 to hear about those.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now we're going to take a much-needed break, and when we come back, we've got listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Okay, every week we tell you about all the cool original content at NintendoWorldReport.com, and this week we'll kick off with the mailbag. Carl Castaneda, our guest last week on this very podcast, has answers this week about Wii media coverage, Kirby on the Wii, Metroid Other M, and the upcoming Vitality Sensor. So if you don't get enough questions answered on the show, go there and get a whole other batch.
And we can't answer questions with comic strips.
No, we can't.
Apparently Carl can.
we can, however, mock our questioners, which he apparently also can do. Also this week, we have a blog from Neil where he was visiting the NOA headquarters, their new building in Redmond. He was there for the Photo Dojo contest, correct?
Yes, which he won.
Yeah, and he got creepy cupcakes with his face on.
Yes, and he got creepy, 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 creepy cupcakes with his face pictured on them.
That restores my faith in balance in the universe. If there's someone who loves their DSi more than Neil, I would be amazed.
Yes.
And he also took the opportunity to do an interview with Bill Trinan about Photo Dojo. And, apparently, John wants me to note that Neil is the ultimate Photo Dojo ninja.
On the review side, Zach has taken up the challenge of how to train your dragon for DS.
Oh no.
Which he feels is similar to a poor man's Pokemon, and it just can't live up to the legendary Nintendo series. So check out his review to find out why. And in features, we have reset button number 2, The Lion King, from Carl, once again, where Carl examines the classic 90s Super NES title, The Lion King, and sets the table for the audio interview with the game's producer, industry veteran Lewis Castle.
Aaron checked out Dragon Quest IX.
Lucky bastard.
Seriously.
And he gives us his thoughts on the local multiplayer.
That's coming out July 11th. Can't wait.
And also, you can check out the latest Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, which is my podcast. This week we have Zach Miller on the show, who gets to talk about one of his favorite games and characters, Kirby, from Kirby Superstar. And yes, it's because of me, damn it, that's been released on Virtual Console this week.
Serendipitous.
So Earthbound for the next Radio Trivia?
Yeah.
I don't know. You have to send a petition my way first.
Well, that'll work.
I have 50 signatures here.
All right. Thanks very much. And be sure to check out all this content at NWR. Okay, we are back with listener mail, and all these people wrote in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and so can you.
.com.
Get to it. Get to it. All right, James has the first letter.
Chris from Chicago writes, "Hi, guys. Like most Nintendo fans, I am eagerly anticipating the release of Super Mario Galaxy 2. Galaxy was the most fun I have had with a video game for years. The sentiment seemed to be mirrored by the gaming press at its time of its release, and you guys even nominated it for your Game of the Decade segment. After Galaxy received so many accolades, I was shocked by the somewhat lukewarm response to the announcement of Galaxy 2. Many journalists, including some of the RFN crew, hoped that it would not simply be, quote, more of the same, or, quote, an expansion pack of its predecessor. It was also said that Nintendo was being lazy with its development by using the same assets and engine from a previous game. I can't understand this line of thinking. The first game was amazing, and I can't wait for this, quote, expansion pack, if it is the same caliber as the first game. Please help me understand the lukewarm reception of Galaxy 2. Am I missing something?"
Well, first off, I want to point out that Nintendo, as with pretty much any large developer, reuses their engine several times. I mean,
yeah,
it's maybe more obvious in this, but I mean, they're not starting from scratch when they make a new game.
No, I mean, they even said, I mean, obviously they modified it quite a bit, but they even said that they reused the Wind Waker engine to make Twilight Princess.
Yeah.
And they used the Mario 64 engine to make Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I mean, they're not going to reinvent the wheel for every game. So that said, I mean, this is as much reusing it as, I don't know, Devil May Cry 1 and Devil May Cry 2 kind of thing. I mean, it's a direct sequel.
They're basically reusing the same game design, and it's something that a lot of other companies do, and Nintendo usually doesn't do.
Right. Yeah, that's the real issue, is the precedent, isn't it? Because this is pretty much without precedent for a Mario game in this way, to have such a direct sequel, really since, I guess, the Japanese Mario 2.
Exactly.
To have something this close,
right,
sort of visually and in terms of the fundamental gameplay mechanics, so I guess that does help kind of explain it somewhat, why, you know, they've set a certain kind of standards for themselves, and they have contradicted those.
Well, and they even have talked about those standards in the past, how, you know, we don't just make direct sequels, we try to do something new. When they flap their gums about this stuff a lot.
Oh, so I mean, I understand it from that point of view. Equally, you know, at the end of the day, I remain extremely enthused about the prospect to play more Galaxy, and, you know, it does seem like they've amped up the challenge, as James was kind of saying before. I'm really excited about that. So I guess the real thing is, it doesn't bother me at all, the idea of them using the same engine assets and all that sort of stuff, as long as the rigorous kind of game design and level design stuff is in there. I mean, that, and obviously, James, you just kind of seem to think that there was, you know, a lot of really good levels in it, and I'll see for myself in 3 weeks' time. But, you know, that's what I'm... Whether I feel like it's lazy or a cash-in, or the proof's going to be in the pudding. When I play it, do I feel like the levels are meticulously put together in a way that says, you know, that's what they put all their effort into, and it shows?
We had that feature discussion on episode X, Greg.
well, you have to say which feature it is.
Yeah, right. It's when we talked about hype.
Oh, yeah. I think that was probably like episode 120.
Was it really? Jeez.
Yeah.
Okay. A long time ago. But I think that's really what it comes down to. Am I hyped for Galaxy 2? No. I have a very positive outlook on it, and I'm very much looking forward to playing it, and I expect that I will have a wonderful time with it. So all of those things, to me, are pretty independent of hype. For me, hype is sort of synonymous with curiosity.
Right.
And I can't really be curious about a game that is such a known quantity.
Well, I mean, like I said, anything in this game, if it showed up in Mario Galaxy, no one would have batted an eye at it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because Galaxy itself was quite varied. I mean, it had a lot of different ideas in it. So you've got different ideas in this, but equally, if you shifted it from one to the other, it would blend in, because it would blend into that sort of mosaic of different ideas that they already had.
Right. I mean, there's so few and there's so little in terms of unknowns in this game. It's hard to be, you know, super excited about getting a new experience, because, I mean, it's not a new experience.
But, I mean, on a smaller scale, even one extra level in the original Galaxy would have been a new experience, just because, as you said, there's so much variety already. Yeah.
Right.
I agree with that. I mean, obviously, one of the things is that it seems weird. We're talking about a sequel... you're coming out 2.5 years later. I mean, these days, that's actually quite a long time after.
I mean, you know,
we talk about annualizable franchises. Certainly 2 years is very common these days for significant games. But of course, Mario has no story, which is often what people might look forward to in a sequel,
even if
it is much the same. Like, it's going to advance the plot, or, you know, if it's like if it's one of these, you know, quote unquote planned trilogies or, you know, whatever, so something like that. You know, you've always got that angle to it with like an RPG or the, you know, certain other games that are plot heavy. Whereas, of course, yeah, Mario doesn't have that.
No, Miyamoto made sure of it.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was ruthless.
It's story. Like, yeah. I think not.
So what it comes down to is, like Johnny says, like, I'm not all that excited about Galaxy in the same way I would have been the first time, or, like, you know, I'm kind of more excited for Other M,
right,
with Metroid, but I would be astonished if I had as much fun with it. That, I mean, that's kind of the point, really, for me. It's because of the intrigue and the curiosity, as Joyce said, around Other M. You know, it's kind of this weird new gameplay.
Well, there's a lot more at stake with Other M. Like, a lot more could go wrong, you know?
It seems sort of crucial to the future of the franchise, so there's a lot more anticipation there, whereas Mario is secure and familiar and, you know, but like I said, in terms of the end product, in terms of how much fun I'm going to get for my money, I mean, Other M would have to be incredibly successful to deliver on the same scale as a Galaxy game.
For me, when Galaxy was coming out, even though the 3D Mario games ranked below maybe two or so Nintendo franchises for me in terms of games I really, really like. 3D platforming was never really my genre to begin with. I had never played, I had just joined staff when Galaxy came out, so I wasn't around to play demos of it beforehand. So all I knew were things like these weird planetettes that you can bounce around and, like, how is that going to work? What's that going to feel like? How are they going to design levels that are basically compartmentalized things that you can bounce between?
Yeah.
Like, all of this was just crazy questions I couldn't reconcile in my head with what I understood about the franchise.
It just sends your imagination reeling.
Right. I mean, I'm trying to contextualize it through Mario 64 and Mario Sunshine, which are very different games from what Galaxy ended up being.
Not according to John.
Well, to be fair, John hasn't played any of them.
No, John's played thousands of them.
That's right. He's played none and 100 of these games. But with Galaxy 2, I can say, well, I can easily map the experience of what I knew about the game on top of Galaxy.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there was a certain sense of wonder for me with Galaxy. A lot of it related to the music as well.
Mm-hmm. You'll be thrilled then. I mean,
yeah, but the point is, like, you know what to expect.
I know what to expect.
There's new songs, and, you know, they're going to be sort of, you broadly fall in line with the first one, but it's not going to be the same sort of thing of, like, oh my God, like, they did this with the music.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to be expecting
That only happened to me, like, once in the entirety of the game, and it was because they basically reprised an old song that that basically died with Mario 64.
Right, so it was not one that's sort of in the usual churn of Mario.
Right, it was.
Thanks for ruining it, man.
I hope it's the desert song.
There's like 55 songs in Mario 64. It's not that big a deal.
I do think that, I mean, I haven't seen that much writing or criticism of, you know, Nintendo being lazy or reusing assets. I don't really think in those terms usually, but I do think maybe it's an interesting question to go around and ask, but what if at the end of this year they announce that Super Mario Galaxy 3 is coming out on Wii in 2012? I think we would start to get pretty critical of
that strategy.
Yeah, well, then I think you was going to say, well, okay, what's so different about this? So, because as I said, I mean, for me, playing the first one, even though there was a pretty good amount of content and stuff, there was a point where I felt like, you know, I wish it kept going, because it felt like it took a little while to get to that sort of challenge level that I was really comfortable with. And then, you know, you kind of hit the end game. So I'm ready for more that's at that challenge level I want. Now, am I going to be ready for even more after you get all the stars in this game? There is a saturation.
Well, you just hit a point of diminishing returns in your design.
Yeah,
exactly. And
you have to upturn it after a certain point. You have to go in a different direction.
Like, I would even go so far as to say, if they made a Galaxy 3, it would be very disappointing.
I'd be amazed.
It's not going
to
happen.
It's very hard to believe
they're doing that. I would be disappointed with them. If they went and made the next 3D Mario game, whatever it is, and then made a 2 to that, I would start to get concerned as well.
If it became a pattern. I mean, it just feels like a very unique set of circumstances.
Right.
Where, yeah, they had this new paradigm for a Mario game. They had this great engine that everyone says, you know, pretty much the best, your consensus sort of best looking game of the system, certainly when the first one came out. And just felt like there were, I don't know, maybe others feel differently, clearly, but I felt having, you know, played through the game twice, you know, with the Ouija and everything, mm-hmm. there was plenty of mileage there left to get out of it, you know, and you know, that's a subjective judgment, but that's the way I felt. Now, would you feel that after two? I kind of doubt it, no matter how good it is.
Well, I find it hard to believe that the development team is going to want to work on another 3D Mario game right after spending 5 years or whatever.
No.
I know.
And Greg, I'd venture to say your appetite for this stuff is probably greater than a lot of people's. I got about 3 stars of Luigi and said, okay, I'm done.
And like I said, I never even got that far.
Hey, Greg, I'm with you, man. I played Ouija at least to the beat the credits. I don't think I've gotten every single star.
No surprise there.
Yeah, really, that's different.
It was. I mean, I did 120 stars on Sunshine in 64. That was a slog. But for Galaxy, it was
more
a
in Sunshine. I think in 64, it's that's
in
a good
64.
Time.
The main slog part is tick tock clock. 100
it's
coins.
It's just brutally difficult.
There's like 105 coins and you need to collect 100 of them.
I think yes. I got to like 85 and there was a power cut and there were unkind things said to the universe.
See, my only real complaint that I had was that they announced 2 Mario games that were effectively both sequels during the same press conference.
Right.
Right.
I think that was the more disappointing moment.
I don't think it was disappointing at all.
Well, I mean, not personally disappointing, but I think that's what might have caused people to go, ugh, and be less enthused.
It's just weird when you always hear people, you know, calling for new franchises, new characters, let's try something different. And Nintendo comes out and says, we have not one, but 2 new Mario Wii games. It's just like, really?
Because Mario as a character is so ubiquitous, it's very it's sort of obvious thing to say, oh God, well, another Mario game, oh, he's everywhere. But the fact is, you know, they didn't do a proper original side-scrolling one for more than a decade.
Right.
And the standard gap between the 3D Marios was 5 to 6 years.
Right. Yes.
I mean, like, as with Zelda and Metroid, they've kind of accelerated the frequency of these releases.
It does feel a little more kind of, you know, commoditized now.
Mm. Right.
And again, I think there is a definite diminishing returns there. I'm quite comfortable with where it is now in terms of, well, you know, maybe we'll double dip on a life cycle. But, you know, more than that.
I want to see him make another, like, Donkey Kong Jungle Beat type bonkers thing. I mean, they could do something like
something
that.
Something that's really out there.
Yeah, really out there. It can be smaller scale. I mean, just let them stretch and do stuff. I mean, they're talented.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Because Mario, the 3D Marios have been in-house before, like, it was probably more difficult for them to do this. I did wonder whether we might get a sequel within the same generation on the basis that it was in a separate development studio from the central EAD, so there wasn't so much pressure for them to go on to other pillars of Nintendo platforms, you know, the next big franchise or whatever.
Well, I mean, now they've sort of compartmentalized what teams make everything, effectively. Yeah.
Which I don't necessarily think that's a good thing. I'm sure it's efficient.
I think it causes some stagnation. I mean, the same team is working on Zelda games, effectively. It is their job to make Zelda.
Anyway, we better move on. Mike, you got the next letter.
Okay, so Jim writes, it seems that you cannot read an article about Nintendo software or hardware these days on other gaming sites without them referring to the games or systems featuring something gimmicky. To me, it seems that a gimmick and a feature are the same thing, except a gimmick is something that the person does not want to see in a game. Also, to me, HD graphics, co-op, online multiplayer, and achievements are gimmicks as well, but they are more widely accepted and do not receive the same condescending remarks. So my question is, what exactly constitutes a gimmick, and what is a feature?
Well, I mean,
HD graphics, to call them a gimmick is insane.
It depends on how they're used.
If it's little more than a marketing tool, then it's a gimmick. If it really adds value, then it's a feature.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's you know, for me, intuitively, you're talking about whether it's something substantive. Yeah, you know, and the problem is with that is somewhat in the eye of the beholder. You know, I mean, I think to some people, something like achievements would be a gimmick. You know, it's like,
I think it is a gimmick.
Am I really doing anything differently? Is this changing how I'm playing it, or am I getting a notification?
I need to get my gamer score up. Damn it.
Yeah, but then other people might say, well, it actually does change the way you play. It does introduce a social element, and maybe you would do things in a game that you wouldn't otherwise do because you've got this sort of social incentive structure.
And I would say it varies from game to game.
It does, right? Because not all achievements are created equal.
What was that game? Was it like Avatar, the Avatar game, where you could get all the achievements by pressing the same button for a few minutes?
It was the Last Airbender Avatar, back in the early days.
It was fantastic.
My answer to this is that these are all features. They're like standard features built into the platform, built into the hardware, whatever. To me, whether it's gimmicky or not is a matter of application. It's a matter of how it's used. So it's something like the microphone in the Nintendo DS. I've complained many times that so many developers do not know what to do with that hardware. And if they don't know how to use it properly, if they don't know how to design it into their games in an intelligent, relevant way, then they shouldn't use it. Because then it becomes a gimmick. Then it becomes blow on this to complete this mini game so that we feel like we used all the hardware capabilities. Now, the microphone itself is a feature of that system, but whether it's used well or not in the game, in the specific game, to me, determines whether it's a gimmick or not.
Yeah, I mean, you go to some like Wii controls. If you're talking about something like the motion in Twilight Princess, you know, that's gimmicky because clearly, given that it's also a GameCube game, there is no difference between you gesturing to swing the sword and pressing a button. Yeah, there is no substantive difference. It is a gimmick that you, rather than physically pressing a button, you're physically flicking a remote in your hand. You know, that is a gimmick. Whereas, you know, something like the motion controls in Wii Sports Resort or something, well, that's not a gimmick because you're interacting with a game in a way you couldn't do without motion control, you know, or just by pressing buttons. So, I mean, that's one example, you know, I think that probably a lot of the time people kind of feel motion controls are gimmicky in general because there are a lot of these ones out there where it's like, okay, well, it's basically just a button press, but we've mapped it to a gesture.
Right.
And there's no doubt that's a gimmick because it's kind of like, you know, there's almost like a sort of minor deception going on.
Look at what you can do.
Oh, you're doing something different. You're not. That's kind of how I see a gimmick in that context.
This is going to be a popular discussion around E3.
Natal move.
Natal and
yes.
Move. Because I think what we haven't been shown yet, and maybe these announcements are just being held until E3, but what we haven't been shown is a real software impetus for those devices to exist. We haven't seen a game or a set of games that can only be done with that hardware and that provides something that we haven't gotten before. And so it feels to a lot of observers, including myself, like these hardware things are basically being thrown in there for marketing purposes to get attention. And that what we've seen so far of games or demos that have been shown for these devices is that they're kind of saying like, well, now we've got this, what can we do with it? Or how can we justify supporting it or even requiring it? And that's not what people want to see.
No.
You know, if I'm not going to buy Natal unless there's a game on it that I really want to play that could only be done with that. And that's generally how I go with not necessarily every Wii game, but certainly the ones that use motion controls. That's what I'm going for.
Here's an example, because just since we've talked about Galaxy a lot, of what would be a gimmick, where there are mini games in there that use the motion controls that don't necessarily work that well because it's a little bit more imprecise than just using the analog stick. Is that game a gimmick? No, but are those little mini games they threw in there just to use the motion controls gimmicky? Well, yeah, but that's, you know, that's just the way it is. It's not necessarily terrible that that's in there. I think the problem is that the gimmick has become such a
pejorative. Yeah.
Right. It's moved beyond what it is.
It's become kind of scathing, where perhaps that's not always how it's intended. I mean,
right.
Sometimes it's more sort of a matter of fact description than it is a vicious sort of criticism.
The problem is there's not another word to use in its place that has less of a negative connotation.
Hey, Mario Tennis has gimmick courts. They're called gimmick right in the name. I mean,
so
sometimes gimmick isn't, I mean, they're not supposed to necessarily be.
It's not always meant pejoratively.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some, you know, games that have a lot of mini games in them, often they try to be gimmicky. It's like, well, isn't this funny right here? Isn't this funny right here? And I mean, that's the concept behind Mario Party. You know, most of those mini games are gimmicks, and that's the purpose. That's the point. It's to be, isn't that funny? You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. It's usually associated with things that are kind of superficial.
Yeah.
And I think that obviously, you know, when you're talking about gameplay, there's, you know, you typically want it to be a lot of, you know, especially the sort of what you might call the core gaming media, whatever, you know, they're looking for your gameplay that's sort of deep and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, if to say something's gimmicky is an insult, essentially, because you're saying it's sort of shallow.
Yeah.
Right.
So I mean, we talked a lot about like controls, but I'm a little curious about the other stuff you mentioned, like HD graphics, co-op, and online multiplayer. I think they can be gimmicks. I mean, for example, when Xbox 360 first came out, they said there will be no standard definition games on our system, period. And they were forcing like arcade games that wanted to come out on Xbox Live to create a version that's high resolution, even though it's freaking Pac-Man. And that's a gimmick. If it doesn't make sense to do that, why?
It doesn't really add.
It doesn't
anything.
Add anything.
Well, and you guys remember all the like the really early Activision releases on Xbox 360, where they were basically the PS2 version, just kind of up-resed, but not really.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand why they did it though. It's beyond a marketing thing, because
to establish a certain environment.
Right. I mean,
it's the same reason that all these Wii games were ported from PS2 and GameCube, and they just added terrible waggle to it.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, they kind of had to do it because they had to set that standard from the beginning, even though it didn't always make sense. I mean, they had to basically set the standards so they could say in the future that people wouldn't go cheap on them and put out games.
Certain environment they wanted to create. It was about fostering certain perceptions about what that system was.
And to me, that's a marketing gimmick. I would call that a gimmick.
Well, gimmicks are a lot about perception. That's really the thing. You know, you're trying to make you see it as something that perhaps beneath the surface it really isn't. At least really when it's used in that kind of negative sense. And you know, I mean, some of these other ones, I mean, you know, multiplayer, I mean, it sometimes,
absolutely,
you know, there are features in games that are there primarily for box ticking, you know, just to say you've got it in there.
Like Metroid Prime 2's multiplayer.
Well, that there are worse examples than that, I think.
That's a pretty bad example, though.
One day we should come back and have a real discussion about Metroid 2, Prime 2 multiplayer, because I have some thoughts on that. But
oh, no.
We need to move
on. Let's not discuss that. We're good.
We need to move on, and Greg is going to read the next letter.
Yep, so this is another one of Abdul's questions from last week. We used one of his questions that he wrote for us in a long letter last time. This is another one. And Abdul wrote, in RFN episode 192, Johnny said something interesting while discussing the next Zelda title. Making voiceovers for the major characters other than Link would help deliver the story and character interactions. Personally, I feel that this is not true at all. In my opinion, voiceovers, if not done correctly, which is like 90% of the time, can be a game killer. Because if you don't believe in it or you don't like it, it'll be like a wall that will stand between you and whatever happens on screen. Giving the player something to imagine in his mind, in this case it's the voices of the characters, is magnitudes better than the risk of painting the picture in the wrong way with poor voice acting. So my question is, how do you feel about having voice acting in the next Zelda title? Do you guys think it'll actually help deliver the story in a better way? Do you think text-based interactions in general is outdated and should stop existing in today's games?
Oh.
Okay, well, first off, text has a time and a place. Absolutely should still have text for at least tutorials, things like that. You don't need every freaking thing to be voiced. Well,
it's just also not cost efficient either.
Yes, exactly.
Especially for budget titles.
It cost hundreds of dollars an hour to record. I mean, and as in hours of recording time to record voiceover work. I mean, in my many, many lives in different professions, I've done this. It's like
you've been a voice actor.
I've worked in voice acting recording.
Oh my!
It's like $500 an hour to rent a studio, have a professional voice actor who's union and scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just like a low level person. If you're trying to get really high talent, it's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be horses for courses with this sort of thing. If you've got a game that wants to have, you know, a lot of dialogue, you know, or character interactions or whatever, but it's a downloadable game, it's a handheld game, or it's a, you know, console game, just doesn't have a huge budget or whatever, then straight away, text is the obvious way that you can deliver that experience while remaining cost effective. And then I think the other real part of it is just that, yes, I mean, it's the less risky one, not just in cost terms, but because it's obviously still need good writing, but it's relatively a lot safer when you're kind of apportioning some of that responsibility onto the player in terms of their imagination, rather than having to bet it all on the voice actors and the director and everything. You're pulling it off just right.
It's not just the actor's capacity to deliver the lines properly and the director's ability to interpret the script into such a way that they want the lines delivered, but it also comes down to casting the right person to fill the role.
Yeah.
And the problem is that it might be difficult, especially if you're doing what Nintendo would inevitably be doing and releasing a game across multiple cultural environments, even if it's just the English-speaking world. There's different cultures here, especially apparently in Australia, where it takes a month to import games. Yeah. That it may be that of one voice works particularly well in one place, but in another place that the type of voice, the inflection they use, the style of which they say things, doesn't work the same way. It's not the culturally proper way to convey an emotion in that respect. It's a very risky proposition, and there's a lot of variables that have to come into play.
A lot of things that can go wrong.
Yeah, and even a well-delivered, well-acted voice acting can be bad.
Well, and then there's the issue of being consistent, too. I mean, if you're going to do voice acting for everything, you have to have your script down pat early. Or be able to wait until the very end to do recording, which is probably not a good idea.
Oh, and it'll cost you way more that way.
So, I mean, there are places that can go wrong all over the place. And inconsistency, I mean, if 90% of the stuff is voice and then all of a sudden you're running across this happens in RPGs where you run across a section where there all of a sudden isn't voice acting. You're like, well, why isn't there voice acting? That's weird. And it takes you out of the whole world.
Well, see, Mike, I'm sure you've noticed in Final Fantasy 13, every single piece of dialogue in that game is voice acting.
Yes, it may have incredible production values in it, and it shows, but they're Square Enix, and that's their flagship title. You cannot expect that of every single game.
Yeah, I mean, that game probably cost $50 million plus to make. I mean, it's obscene.
How many years?
It's in development for like 107 years.
So what about Zelda?
Well, about Zelda, first of all, I'm very deeply skeptical that you'll have any significant amount of voice acting.
Just got orchestrated music a couple of years ago for Mario.
We'll see if even that carries through to Zelda. Frankly, I mean,
there was very little orchestration in Twilight Princess. It's like two songs.
And they've hinted that they want to do more. But I don't think I want Zelda to have voice acting, and I don't think Nintendo ever would, because they wouldn't be able to do it right, and I think they know they would not be able to do it right.
Well, my concern is the sheer number of characters that they would either have to choose to voice act, or they'd have to make the active decision when to do it and when not. And I don't necessarily know that they have the experience in doing voice acting on when to make that decision.
And as I've said many times, it's just not the plot, the story. I don't think it's a hugely important part of the game to them. So the idea that they're going to get locked down those elements early that would be conducive to that kind of production where you're going to have voice acting, all that kind of stuff, it seems very, very much. Unlikely.
That's a good point too, because I mean they care so little about the story, they don't even bother to try to retroactively establish continuity with other games. It's like, hey, it's fine, don't worry about it, let's go.
I have a smattering of thoughts on this. First off, I think Zelda is the reason that I made the original comments on this is I think Zelda is already in a hard place with this, because they've pushed far enough into cinematic storytelling and even partial realism, etc., that it feels weird walking around, or not even, not, it's not just the walking around towns talking to people. It's when they actually have cutscenes and it's still just in text as characters are trying to have conversations.
Right.
That shit is awkward in Twilight Princess, and that, it really takes you out just as much as bad voice acting would.
Well, I would venture that it would take that impact, that sort of feel of it being a bit off would be far more acute to someone coming in more cold to the series. Like, we're used to it. I mean, we can kind of extrapolate.
it's true, I am.
Twilight Princess is far more cinematic than previous Elders and stuff, and there are kind of more dialogue scenes, and we would feel it more. But you know, we've played the others, we were expecting that. Whereas, I mean, if you're someone just coming into it from the outside, I think they could be off-putting. I mean, I understand that
it's
point.
Like, and I think that gets back
to... Where's the voice?
Yeah, I mean, and that gets back to what we're talking about before, about development teams getting kind of mired in themselves and there not being enough cross-pollination, so to speak, in Nintendo. Those people have been working on Zelda for a decade, and to them, yeah, that's the way it is. That's business as usual. Why would you want something different?
I mean, we've built every 3D Zelda that's ever come out. We don't need voice acting.
I would be more okay with them sticking with text if the writing was higher quality.
Yeah.
But it's not. In Zelda, the writing is not. This is hardly even Mario and Luigi level.
It certainly isn't. No. To me, the priorities tell you everything. You know, and the story isn't a priority. The writing isn't a priority. And so the idea that you're then going to sort of, with those as your foundation, spend a lot of money on voice acting, which could actually take what you've got and make it less effective.
It'll make it more glaringly weird.
It seems bizarre, but there's some interesting parallels with Metroid.
Sammy.
We've had Metroid games with no voice acting.
Sammy.
We've had
Metroid games with voice acting for the supporting characters apart from the protagonist, and now we're going to get a Metroid game with voice acting for everyone, including Samus.
Yes.
And so you've kind of got the whole range there. And, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how people handle Samus having her own voice and going into a character and all this stuff. Because, you know, I remember, you know, for some of the younger listeners who probably wouldn't have any concept of this, but I remember just like when Mario 64 came along, a lot of people were weirded out by Mario's voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a completely ridiculous voice.
Is weird vocalizations. I mean, he's not speaking dialogue or anything, but it's like, well, that's not how Mario sounds. What the hell is this? You know, when people weren't used to it. And so, I mean, I think there could be, if they ever did it with Link, or that, you know, they are doing it with Samus, it'd be a lot of that, especially because it is a lot more kind of substantive than just the little yelps.
I don't know. I mean, how many times did it take Square Enix before they got the voice acting right in their Final Fantasy games?
Well, the first time they did it was 10.
And it was bad.
But see, at the time, it wasn't regarded as bad.
Oh,
as
no,
it is now.
I regarded it as really bad.
Well, fine, but it was not.
It couldn't be worse than Bat and Kaitos. I'm sorry.
Well, maybe.
But no, you know what? No, it could be worse than Bat and Kaitos, because the first trailer of Bat and Kaitos was worse than the actual game. They recut the whole thing because it was so bad.
I have a couple of ideas about how Nintendo could get around this problem. Okay. Because like I said, right now I feel like they're kind of stuck. They kind of have to do it, or it becomes more and more weird that they don't, right?
Mm.
Even if they go and do like another Wind Waker style game, which I don't think they're going to, for at least for this cycle. But
sadly,
even if they went back to that, Wind Waker's a pretty cinematic game too.
Mm.
So even then, I think it could possibly be an issue for them. So let me suggest a couple of ways. First off, you could do a really stylized voice acting so that people aren't holding it up to the standards of movies or something like that. So it could be like a fake language, or just maybe, I really like the way Dragon Quest VIII does it, where everybody has a pretty strong British accent of one dialect or another. And at first it's like, wow, this sounds corny.
Yeah.
But actually, pretty quickly, you get used to it, and you start to really like it. I found, I mean, that's it's, you know, over 100 hours by the end of it. And it helps that the writing's really good in that game.
So does give Link like a strong Scottish accent?
No.
Well, Wind Waker had the Celtic vibe going on.
A little bit, yes, but it's, even in the music.
Well, that's really where it comes
well,
from.
Well, there are a few other things, color-wise and stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Or even give them some kind of moon language, like an eco or something.
You know, oh, no. I mean, are you Sim speak for everybody?
I mean, maybe they all speak Hylian, and we just can't understand it. And that covers up a lot of potential pitfalls, right?
I mean, there's a separate issue of just having Link have dialogue, whether it's in text or whatever. I mean,
right,
you know,
yeah.
I mean obviously that's something that Metroid is dealing with this time, and it's the double whammy because you got voice acting too, but...
Well, to be fair, I mean, they can't do worse than they've already done in Metroid, so we're good.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't think the voice acting, I mean, like, totally god-awful terrible in 3. I mean, it wasn't the best thing ever, but...
I would say the other... And this is... I'm glad we got back to Metroid, because I think the other lucrative path that they could go down with Zelda is to actually take it more into Metroid territory, where they could simply build a story around their game that doesn't involve Link talking to dozens and dozens of bullshit characters.
Hey, that bug lady is not bullshit.
Look, I'm just saying.
No, she's creepy. I don't want to. If Agatha is ever in another Zelda game, I'm just turning it off at that point.
I have always wanted to know what an elderly person with wheels for feet has to say. And I discovered that in Spirit Tracks. So if you're proposing to take that joy away from me, Johnny, I tell you, go fuck yourself.
It's getting too... It's becoming like Link and his shitty friends, right?
But
can we just get rid of all these other characters?
If they went back to something more like Majora's Mask, where the characters are interacting and Link is sort of... It's interesting, but he's not really interacting with them. He's more of a facilitator.
Yeah. He's a voyeur. He's a creepy stalker.
And I have another idea, Johnny. Or if they wanted to still avoid the voice acting, they could go really stylized more so than Wind Waker. Like, if they did something that was like a manga or something, then it might make sense to do text. But they need to make it...
Hmm.
Your point of there being a disconnect between kind of realistic visuals and text, they need to go one way or the other.
It's kind of, yeah, they got right now you got a kind of storytelling that, you know, it seems like it should have dialogue, but it doesn't. And like you could go in the other way and say, actually, why don't we have a kind of storytelling style which doesn't do it? Like you said, if it was almost like a comic book style.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Legend of Zelda Comic Zone.
I think there are, I'm just saying there are a number of pathways out of this danger zone that they're in.
I don't know. I
kind of expect Nintendo to maintain position in the sort of fudge that they are currently.
I mean, with respect to their core franchises, they're a very conservative company.
Say whatever you like about the previous Metroid stories and stuff, but it does seem like Sakamoto actually gives a shit about the Samus character, for you know, whether that's, you know, whether you think that's valid or not, whereas I'm not convinced that anyone does about Link. You know, he is just sort of an avatar.
Right. I mean, he has no story. He can be wherever they want him to be, whenever they want him to be.
Right. Mario has more story than him. Not in his main games, but in the spin-offs, he's been allowed to have more story than Link.
I mean, he's more of an identity.
Exactly.
Link's job is to exist in a story they put him in. He himself is not the character. I mean, the world is more the character than
Link.
Right,
and if he's not a character, why does he need to have interactions with all these other terrible characters that have been put in the game for no reason? I mean, you guys are familiar with Shadow of the Colossus, right? I mean,
that's not.
I'm just saying, it is a potential way for them to
go. No, it's not. It totally isn't.
Sure it is.
No, because the idea of the Zelda games isn't that Link's just going on some quest to go kill something.
Have you played the original Legend of Zelda?
Well, fine. we're going to disregard that game.
That's where it all
comes
from.
What Majora's Mask does well is it emphasizes the character interactions between other characters.
Right.
It's not all one-on-one with Link.
But see, Link's job in that game isn't just to rescue some princess. Link's job is to save the people of that world.
But the point is, a lot of other Zelda stories, they only interact with him. They only exist to spout shit at Link's face.
Yeah. But see, I don't understand why they had to make that regression into basically going from this is a world.
Because it's not a priority. I mean, that's why.
I don't understand why they made it a priority just for the sake of this is this game's gimmick. And yes, I use the word gimmick in relation to another question. I don't care.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and it's a very good question, and
I don't have an answer.
For me, this is one of the most interesting stories going into E3. This is
really
one of the things. Yeah. I mean, how they approach it. What it, you know, they're, I feel like they're at a crossroads with that franchise.
Do you mean it at a higher plane, not just the voice acting question?
Yeah, but I feel like voice acting is inherently tied into whatever direction they take the franchise.
I don't know. I think they're going to stay conservative and stay the course.
Well, maybe they do.
The smart money kind of, you know, it seems safe there. But an interesting thing that came out of this, I think it was a Miyamoto interview with the German media. So
we've got
a bit of a, you know, sort of fun ass mirror thing going on here because we've got a translation of a translation. stuff, but he said something basically that, you know, unlike in other Zelda games, they didn't really do the visual part of the game first, and that's why they haven't shown anything yet. That they kind of worked on the gameplay parts of it.
It's a text-based adventure, basically, is what you're telling
before me. Before they tackle the visual design of the game. And certainly he's talking about making it simpler and more accessible and all that stuff. So it sounds like it could be, you know, a bit of a, you know, how does Wii Motion Plus do Phantom Hourglass? Like, that's kind of the vibe I'm getting, but I'm not sure how that's going to play out.
I think I said it a long time ago, but I would not be totally surprised if they go for, like, 2D for a lot of this. I mean,
I would be surprised if only because it's about as unconservative a move as they could make. And it still be somewhat in character. I don't feel like there's the great retro appeal of the 2D Zelda games like there was for 2D Mario games for the average player.
I'm saying 2D side scrolling. I'm saying Zelda 2.
Oh.
I'm saying Zelda 2.
Dude, you are out on a limb with that.
Wow.
That is.
You need to be tested if that happens.
We need to end this question because
ESP
that is terrifying.
Well, that is going to be the last email of the week, and you can send your questions and comments and suggestions and other feedback about anything we've talked about or haven't talked about to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Those are the initials of our show.
In case you were wondering.
Yes.
The mystery solved.
Mike, I believe you have already pimped your podcast. You've already plugged yourself here, but of course Radio Trivia is awesome and everybody should go subscribe to it. We also have another sister podcast called the NWR Newscast, where you can, on the latest episode, you can hear the podcast debut of Pedro Hernandez, one of our most prolific writers on the website staff, and who knows what they're going to have next time. Also, make sure that you didn't miss the reset button number 2 audio format that is on the same podcast feed as RFN, so you can grab that off iTunes if it didn't automatically download, depending on when you refresh, so be sure that you don't miss that. It's going to be really interesting. You can hear all about The Lion King for Super Nintendo and a bunch of other crazy stuff. I think Boom Blocks is in there as well. So that should be really good.
Does he ask who made the box art? He needs to ask who makes the box art.
I'm sure he's really concerned.
He should be.
Thanks very much to our guest, Mike Cole.
Well, you're very well.
For coming on and doing this. And have to get you back on sometime soon.
Okie dokie.
Great job, man. All right. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
What's up, y'all?
Oh, was that to us?
I'm waiting for the intro to come to me.
Maybe that was the intro.
God, it's hot.
That big sigh.
Just to stop listening now.
Hey, everybody, it's Radio Free. I gotta give you a better break point than that, Greg.
Yeah.
The only problem for this is that Greg's now run out of recent Zelda clones. And
yeah, if Zelda Wii comes out this year, it'll be my third Zelda game this year.
First one called Zelda.
When does the Okami...
That's 2011 for
apparently
the West.
Apparently it's 2011. That's weird.
It just seems weird for just simply from the point of view that, you know, by the time it comes out, 3DS is going to be...
By the time it comes out, everyone who played Okami will be dead.
Is that a threat, Jay?
But it'll be a short list.